still wisdom prevailing in the world. My intent is to be consistent with the tradition of holy hilarity at this nice village and up in the mountains where we're all fit and feeling fine, to bring in some good news, if you will, the gospel about fitness and fatness as it's perceived in 1980. This is one of those subjects about which everybody's an expert, since we've all been trying to be fit and less fat since birth, but in which there are still a great many misconceptions. And what we're going to try and do is not bring absolute truth into the world this afternoon, but simply say what the answers are as they're seen in 1980. One of my professors in biochemistry in medical school said, "Good news this year, class, we have the same final exam as last year, only the answers have changed." In the whole area of fitness and fatness, the answers have been changing a bit too, and I want to bring some of that insight to you in a way which is simple and practical and which we can all take home and apply to ourselves and share with our friends and neighbors. By way of introduction, my name is Steve Yarnell. I'm a practicing physician in internal medicine and cardiology in north of Seattle, Washington, in Edmonds, Washington. And a good bit of my practice is concerned not just with trying to repair broken down machines, but to try and keep machines in the form of human bodies fitter. And when you look at all of the effort which each of us puts into repairing and keeping fit the various machines in our life, from automobiles to televisions and the other things and gimmicks that we work with, and how little attention we pay to understanding the machine, the only machine we have to go through life with, it's a bit of a disgrace. So one of the things that I hope to do this afternoon is to give you a little bit more insight in how your machine works, so you can do a little bit more in the way of preventive maintenance and get some better mileage out of it. One of the things that we can't do in the aging process is to control the calendar. But one of the things we can do is to control the rate of all of those processes, which are called aging. In fact, we don't grow older, we just grow more decrepit and have increased risks at certain rates, and those are controllable. So calendar age is not a certain sentence for certain disabilities, but merely a challenge as we go along to maintain fitness. The body is indeed the temple of the soul, and what we're going to focus on today is that body in which your soul resides for these limited number of years on Earth. Perspective Tom Rossing gave us in The Powers of Ten, it says indeed that we're here but a fleeting instant, and when you perceive the smallness of it all, it at least deserves our attention for an even smaller focus of that brief wink that we're on Earth. The two symbols of Christmas are Jesus and Santa Claus, and I find it a bit amusing to begin with that Santa Claus, as a roly-poly, obese character, sedentarily riding around on his sleigh, and getting the most of his exercise hopping up and down chimneys, which is a bit of a paradox in itself, which used to always perplex each of you as a child, as it did me. How can this fat thing squeeze down the chimney? It was a bit of an amoebic trick, to be sure, and also a bit of a paradox that if he was really so fit hopping up and down chimneys all over the world, how could he possibly be so fat? But nevertheless, the image of fatness and giving and fatness and joviality and good humor is with us, and I believe it's no accident that one big part of the Christmas image is fatness and feasting and Santa Clausness. The other part central to Christians, of course, is the image of the birth of Jesus. And as we picture Jesus through his years of ministry, nowhere do I picture the image of somebody who is fat and sedentary. There's not a great deal of lecturing in the Bible about staying fit, because there weren't an awful lot of alternatives. You really couldn't ride a bus or a car from place to place. And if you had to climb a hill, you didn't take a cable car. And if you had to climb up inside some sort of building, however high it might be, there wasn't an elevator or an escalator. Fitness was a way of life. And in fact, the problems that you faced as a citizen of those days were those of famine and problems in which indeed fatness conveyed a certain type of protection. Because fat, as we'll see, and as we know, is a great way to store energy and to protect you against famines. Fat, then, is not all bad. Historically, it's had some very good things, as we'll see. But I think the image of Jesus as a fit person is one that we want to keep in our minds as we think about our own lives. One of the historical perspectives, then, on fitness and fatness that I would leave just by way of these introductory comments, and by way of saying that I'll be speaking for a few minutes and then opening it for wider discussion, is that fitness up until the last few years in this brief glimpse of history that we're living in Fitness was a necessary way of life. There weren't alternatives when you were working on the farm and when you were doing manual labor and when you were getting around on foot instead of by vehicle. You had no choice. Fitness then was a way of life that people took for granted. And what has changed in recent times has been the increasing automation of society, the increasing mechanization, so that fitness now becomes something that we have to make into a bit of a ritual to achieve what all of our ancestors spent great effort to get away from. Fatness, likewise, in the past, not only was a protection against famine, but was, and for some people today, still is a protection against cold. Fat is a very good insulating material, as you all know, and it's sort of a comfy, nice thing to have around you on a cold night. Those of you that don't have enough fatness suffer more than those of you who have more. It's a good blanket to have in a time when you might be at risk of freezing to death or getting ill from that. It's a problem. Also, historically, some of the infectious diseases, particularly tuberculosis, were associated with thinness and malnutrition. And the various scourges of malaria and other forms of illness in the world today are associated with thinness. So it's probably no accident that all of our good grandparents and up to our own parents made the business of cleaning your plate a matter of Christian pride and ethic, because there were other people that were starving. And it's only been recently that we've seen that it's a greater sin to turn your body into a garbage pail in cleaning your plate than it is to deposit worshipfully any leftover foods and then take less the next time. It's a reorientation of our thinking in which we choose not to see our bodies as depositories and garbage pails for cleaning plates to please beneficent mothers worried about starving people in China. So it's taking a new attitude, isn't it, about fatness and fitness. Some of the problems with fatness and lack of fitness are well known to all of us. Perhaps one of the bigger immediate problems that fatness brings on is a lack of self-esteem. And I have only the greatest awareness and pity for people that lack that self-esteem when they can't really look at themselves in the mirror and be proud and say, I'm glad I'm me and I'm glad for the body that I'm going through this world on. That's something which must be a very demeaning thing for any of us, not to feel a certain sense of pride. And for people looking for jobs, for people going through the world and carrying a certain testimony about the meaning of life and the meaning of their religion, to have this as an outer advertisement of their sense of awareness of the temple of their soul is indeed a problem for many people. And therefore, if it were a hopeless problem, we would have one set of attitudes, but since it's a problem which there is hope and much that can be done, something we can address. Medically, of course, fatness is well known to correlate with an increased risk of just about every disease you can think of except malnutrition. It even correlates with suicide, as you might expect. The increase in cancer with fatness is established, particularly cancer of the uterus in women. It's well established. Fat appears to be a very strong way of holding toxins in the body, and particularly carcinogenic toxins, so that those people who are terribly concerned about diet and exposure to carcinogens ought to look about the part of their body which is storing those things as it does in animals. There's much we could say about fatness in terms of its medical problems, in terms of hypertension, hardening of the arteries, premature death from heart attack and stroke, in which when we then are encouraging children to have another cookie and to become fat, when we're treating celebrations as excuses to promote fatness, there's a sort of paradoxical way of encouraging a shortness to life, statistically. Lack of fitness, once again, has a certain amount of problems with it. Again, the problem which physicians see most frequently with lack of fitness is lack of energy, the complaint of I'm tired. I don't really feel great when I wake up in the morning. I'm tired all day long. I'm weaker than I used to be. I don't have the concentration that I would like. I'm depressed. Various complaints of the psychological sort are the primary presentation of lack of fitness and frequently drive people to seek and spend money on medical attention, which could well have been handled by a fitness program consuming no more than 60 minutes a week, as we will discuss. 60 minutes of totally free time, which is more than recaptured in savings in sleep that's not needed, because the person who's fit simply gets along on less sleep, and the savings in terms of an efficiency factor, Tom, is a real one. So lack of fitness then presents these various psychological problems. It can be a real cause of anxiety and a cause of depression, And in fact, many physicians and clinics have now found that a primary treatment for anxiety and depression is physical fitness, letting aside all of the analytic approaches to why are you anxious or why are you depressed. Lack of fitness is further correlated with all of the major diseases which cause premature death and disability, including arthritis and hypertension, and early disease from coronary disease. So there's a lot of things to be said about fatness and lack of fitness that would command our attention. Now, I promised that I would discuss in very simple and useful terms some of the basic biochemistry, what happens to the intake of protein, fat, and carbohydrate, which are basic dietary substances. Protein, carbohydrate, and fat are interrelated substances useful in producing tissue and enzymes in the case of protein, and useful for fat and carbohydrate in producing energy, among other functions. Now, the protein which can produce tissue and enzymes is, of course, of animal and vegetable sources that we'll have more to say about, but is convertible to fat and is convertible to carbohydrate. The main part of the energy cycle that we're going to direct our attention at for the point of view of being practical is the interrelationship of carbohydrates, which are complex and simple, the complex carbohydrates being the whole grain starches and vegetables, and the simple carbohydrates being the processed flours and sugars and fruits and alcohols. So we have the carbohydrates and the fats going through two basically different kinds of energy cycles. The carbohydrate, sugars, and other form starches are anaerobically converted into energy primarily, which means they don't require for the major part of the cycle any oxygen. This, from the point of view of surviving in the jungle, is very essential. It's what allows you to leap from tree to tree and to jump away like a cat from your enemy and to do many things which require short-term bursts of energy, in which the energy metabolism of muscle may increase 50 times within a split second. While your brain drolls on along trying to figure out what's happened, the muscle has already twitched anaerobically with great energy expenditure. It's what allows sprinters and other people to be good athletes. The other end, though, is the slow-burning energy cycle, which is fat, which is aerobic, which means oxygen requiring and consuming. This is a slow burning thing. This is what allows you to run for days through the jungle or for hours. This is what allows you to sustain energy. And as we will see, what is happening in these two basic pathways, which we all inherit, is a difference, one of us from the other, and each of us having a choice determined by how we will influence our own metabolism as to how much we will be anaerobic and how much we will be aerobic. Therefore, not only how much energy we will generate, but how we will generate it. And as we will see, that will have a fundamental importance on how we handle fats and how fit we are. In focusing a little bit more then on the carbohydrate and fat pathways for energy metabolism, as we said, proteins can be converted into carbohydrates and go through an anaerobic pathway to pyruvic acid, which then enters a cycle in common with the fat pathway, which initially requires oxygen in a pathway called beta oxidation, involves a number of enzymatic steps which are oxygen dependent. The fat then enters aerobically what the carbohydrate and protein enter anaerobically into pyruvic acid and energy. If you continue to exercise at a very high level or have great energy requirements with enough oxygen available, the oxygen will allow the pyruvic acid to be further broken down to carbon dioxide and water with further energy expenditure, so that the final stages of energy production, if there's enough oxygen available, are aerobic. If you're exercising, for example, at an extremely high level, you're then exercising at what's called anaerobic levels. The oxygen won't be enough to convert energy, and you will develop through anaerobic pathways lactic acid, which then, as it accumulates, will cause pain in your muscle with the accumulation of lactic acid products in muscle and can then be converted to fatty acids for storage. A bit about what's happening in fat itself and protein and carbohydrate as they are stored in the body. Fat is a very bulky, fluffy, high-energy stuff. It's very concentrated, however, in energy. Even though it's very lightweight stuff, as we will see and discuss, it's 9 calories per gram, or 500 grams of pure fat would be 4,500 calories. So in 500 grams, which is about 1.1 pounds, there would be about 4,500 calories if it were pure fat. Subtracting for the amount of 10% or so of water and other substances, you're ending up with a pound of fat in your body is approximately 3,500 calories. Pure protein and carbohydrate is compact and dense in proportion to fat. In fact, it's more dense than water. It's 4 calories per gram, however, so it is less than half the energy concentration per unit weight. Or 500 grams, then, of protein or carbohydrate would be approximately 2,000 calories. Now, it's of interest to know that a championship marathon runner, certainly not myself or anyone that I know personally, but Frank Shorter type people, can run a marathon in about 2.5 hours, consuming 800 calories per hour, which is about 2,000 calories. That would be just slightly more than 1 pound, if you had it available, of carbohydrate or stored sugar. It would actually be less than 0.5 pound of fat. So that energy, even of the most incredible sorts, like running a marathon in near record time, is not the way to lose 0.5 pound of fat. And because of this, many nutritionists and other misguided individuals, and physicians in particular, have said exercise is no way to lose fat. If you can only lose 0.5 pound by running a marathon, it's got to be the world's dumbest way to exercise. So we have seen generations of physicians and nutritionists preaching diets. And as we will see, diets don't work, and we will see why exercise indeed does work, in spite of this peculiar paradox that you have to run a marathon to lose 0.5 pound. Before we get to the explanation of the paradox of why exercise helps you lose fat and achieve fitness, let's look at some of the things that happens to all of us, either as we grow older, or more properly spoken, as we grow less fit. Changes in body composition with loss of fitness may be an increasing amount of fatness, even without weight change. So here's a person, hypothetically, at age 20, growing 20 years older to age 40, with a weight increase from 120 to 125, saying proudly to all one's friends, I've only gained 5 pounds in 20 years. However, let's look what's happened. The percentage of fat in this person has gone from 22% fat to 30% fat, meaning an increase in pounds of fat from 26 to 38 pounds of fat, and an increase in pounds of lean body mass, LBM, a decrease in lean body mass from 94 to 87. So that if that person at age 40 were still to have 22% fat, which is approximately a goal for a woman, if that person were still to have 22% fat, they should weigh only 112 pounds instead of 125. So though they've gained 5 pounds on the scales, they're 13 pounds too fat. So this is what's happening to a lot of us as we grow older, if we grow older without staying fit. As I mentioned at the beginning, we have no choice about calendars, but we do have choices about fitness. This needn't happen to us if we choose not to have it happen. The goal then for all of us is loss of excess fat, not loss of weight. Certainly not loss of weight as lean body mass. And the reasons for that will be clear, because lean body mass in muscle is what is the primary factor in our fitness and health, and is the primary machinery for controlling the fat in our body. For indeed, it's not the fat on the outside that helps us float in water, that keeps us warm, and that protects us against famine and starvation. It's the fat on the inside which is of concern to each of us, because as the fat accumulates in this person from age 20 to 40, as they get that extra number of 12 pounds of fat, it's not going on the outside, and this person still fits into clothing approximately the same size and looks fairly good, but their meat is getting marbled. How many of you have looked in the supermarket at marbled meat? Indeed, it's the fat in the muscle that's the concern, and it's the fat around the arteries. Not just the arteries out in the muscles at the end of your arms and legs, but the muscles in your coronary arteries in the heart itself, without which things cease. So as the fat accumulates, it's accumulating as marbled meat and as plugged and clogged arteries, and indeed it's of some concern. So we don't want to lose lean body mass. That's good stuff. Why is it good stuff? Well, muscle burns fat more than it burns sugar. And the ratio at which muscle burns fat more than sugar is determined by your level of aerobic fitness. So you have some control on this. It's not an idle, passive process. This process is controlled by the number of mitochondria that you have in your muscle, by the size of these mitochondria, and by the number of enzymes and the kind of enzymes that you carry on these little bundles of energy that reside inside your muscle cells. So through exercise, you can change the amount of muscle you have as measured in lean body mass, and you can change the composition of the mitochondria in those muscles in a very exciting way. This is why it's very important for you, those of you that are into imaging, to talk to your mitochondria. These little critters have feelings. I mean, they're in there all the time. Hardly anybody ever talks to them. They're there, they're lonely, they need you. So talk to them. And when you go out and exercise in the morning, when you really don't want to, when the mitochondria and the lactic acid in your muscles are stiff and you'd really rather stay in bed, it's the friendly mitochondria calling for reserve forces. They'd like to be more of those guys because they go around, they generate these enzymes that gobbles up that fat in your body, cleans out your coronary arteries, makes you feel fine and wonderful the rest of the day, but they need your help, folks. I mean, they're lonely little critters, so you got to talk to them and be good to them. Aerobic training and fitness changes the way that you burn fuel in your furnace. That's a great image. Your body is basically a furnace, and just like your house, you're going to keep it warm with something or other. And imagine the fireplace with two kinds of fuel that you're going to burn, and a wood-burning and fuel-burning stove that you're going to keep your cabin warm with. If you keep throwing in Kleenex all day, it's like throwing in carbohydrates and sugar into your body. And that's what most people are doing when they're sugar burners and simple carbohydrate burners. They're fueling their house with throwing in Kleenex and newspapers all day. And what you should be doing is putting a few logs on the fire to burn steadily and give a good steady level of energy so you can get on about the business around the house and have to stop worrying about it. The analogy in the human is very simple and very instructive. The illness or problem or symptomatic complex called hypoglycemia is exactly the people that are burning Kleenex in their system all day long. There's a quick flare of energy in with the candy bar, and woof, out comes the insulin, down goes the sugar, symptoms are created. And where does all that sugar go? You've already seen it in the earlier equations that we showed you. When they're not burning enough sugar from your exercise at that one moment, it's got to go somewhere. It quickly fills up the sugar stores, which are very limited in the way of simple sugars and glycogen storage in muscle and liver, and it's got to go somewhere. So where does it go, folks? It goes into fat, because fat is a very efficient way to store energy. So all of that extra energy keeps going into fat. Now, the body's not dumb. It learns. It's got all kinds of these things on the mitochondria, and when you're telling it to do something, it listens, folks. So when you say, learn how to store fat, because I'm going to keep doing it to you, I'm going to keep giving you all of these fast foods, you got to learn to do it. It builds up its reserves as a great force, and it learns how to store fat, and it does it better and better and better. You are converting a kind of furnace in your house then to a Kleenex burning or a sugar burning furnace. If you want to burn fat, you've got to do some fuel converter business. Dieting has failed and will always fail as a primary approach to control of weight, to control of fatness, and to control of fitness. Dieting will not change muscle. It will not change mitochondria. It will not change the basic machinery that you are working with that will accomplish what you want to do, which is to lose fat, not just on the outside, but on the inside where it's doing damage. Diets, in fact, as they are traditionally defined with sort of quotations around them, meaning something weird and strange that you do for a limited time in your life till you can get back to doing what you did before that got you into trouble. Diets will always fail. You see, the ultimate diet, if you think about it, is not eating at all. And if you take a person that's dead and not metabolizing, they're not eating. And dead people don't lose weight except through processes of decay. The reason why we lose weight is through processes of energy expenditure more than it is through dieting. Now, we'll have a few good words to say for diets, but the point is that diets alone fail for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is they have nothing to do with the production of mitochondria in energy-burning systems, and in fact can only make things worse. If you're on the wrong kind of diet, it can make things worse. If you're on the right kind of diet, the best it can do is keep you even in the matter of enzyme production and mitochondria. And the other reason diets, of course, fail is they don't reflect any change in your basic lifestyle or philosophy about everything, which is why people that go on diets are asking for a roller coaster of being where they want to be and then getting fat again, back again to where they want to be, fat again, and continually going through a disillusionment cycle until they finally say, I give up, I can't do it. And then they've accelerated the very thing which is worst about life, which is disillusionment and giving up. On the other hand, lest you think I'm totally an exercise freak, I would say that exercise alone will fail, and indeed fails most markedly in the people that were the classical high school and college jocks that are used to 6,000 calories a day and exercise it off. They're exercising all of the time and controlling their weight. But the reason why exercise alone fails without any concern at all about nutrition and dietary habits as a long-term goal is that one can't maintain much of the level of exercise day in and day out that one maintains when one is young, vigorous, athletic, and competitive. So that exercise alone won't do it. Also, if you are dealing with storing excessive amounts of fat, sooner or later you're going to be breaking down the system. So that we need to look at types of diet habits as a lifelong pattern rather than as an exception to work along with exercise, and types of exercise that are very different than many people have said in the past, namely competitive sports and work, in quotation marks. There is no work currently done in America in any large number of people which contains enough aerobic exercise to achieve fitness. In the old days, there was. Maybe at Holden Village, when people are up doing things for short periods of time, there will be levels of aerobic expenditure sufficient to maintain fitness. But in society as a whole, there's no broad class of work, including housework, including all sorts of work in the post office. You know, the now used to be the postman carried bags around. Now they all travel around in their little carts. So there's no kind of work that will do it. A word on how to measure fitness and fatness, and then on how to maintain fitness. Then I'll summarize with a few comments and throw it open, wide open for your discussion, questions, and observations. Measuring fitness and measuring fatness are something which you can do if you'd like to measure things. And one reason to measure things, it's a measure of achievement. And these are good things because unlike a lot of areas of healthcare, you can't really measure things very well. You can measure fitness pretty well by answering the question, can you walk 3 miles? And if you can walk 3 miles, how long does it take? Now, we've dealt with a lot of this with people that have handicaps, programs in nursing homes, in other areas. For each special group of individuals and for each individual, there's a measure of fitness. And the last thing I would want to do would be to hold up a hallmark of fitness that everybody of a certain age and sex should achieve. The measure of fitness should be your own, and it should be something that you're comfortable doing that you can measure now. If it's walking 3 miles or running a mile or doing something, if you're paraplegic, you can do things with your arms. If you're quadriplegic, you can do things with your neck. If you have any available muscle groups left to exercise, they can be exercised. The timing, intensity, and duration can be measured, and a measure of fitness can therefore be attained. And with a diary approach, you can show in your own life through a program of fitness training improvement in where you are. It's the one thing that you can guarantee success in, which is why we've had great success using it for psychological counseling, for anxiety, depression, and other emotional problems, because you can take a person and have them come in, and as you're talking to them, they're walking on a treadmill, or they're on a bicycle or ergometer, and they're doing something which we know you can do, and the next day you're going to do a little bit more, and you can absolutely guarantee success, and you can do it for yourself. So you can measure it in yourself through something like a measured adherence to a walking or other program, and you can measure time and speed for a particular distance. Fatness is not well measured, incidentally, on a scale. That's what most people do. They say, you know, put the bathroom scale before the refrigerator. Not a very useful thing to do. In fact, when you enter a proper program of achieving level of fitness, you may gain weight. The reason you may gain weight is that you're putting on muscle, and muscle, as we said, is heavy stuff. It's good machinery, but it's heavy machinery. And the fat that you're losing as you're entering this fitness program is light, fluffy stuff that's high in terms of calories. So you can be burning off a lot of calories in terms of fat, losing fat, but putting it on in terms of muscle, which contains more water, and indeed you may either have a slower level of weight loss or you may even gain weight initially. Fatness is best measured by what's called hydrostatic weighing or water immersion, in which the person is weighed underwater. And the principle, very simply, is that fat floats and muscle sinks. And using an equation which accounts for the residual lung volume of air, which also gives you flotation, it's possible to calculate with fair precision the percentage of fat in your body in relationship to the rest of your body. When one does that, then you find out that fatter people, indeed, as they get 30 or 40% body fat, you may have to put weights on them to make them sink, because fat people float. And for all of those of you who always had trouble floating in a swimming pool, be proud. If you're a sinker, you're okay. If you're a floater, you've got some work to do. So when you do this, you establish some criteria for optimal body weight in terms of fat and muscle. And the interesting paradox of this is that there are many people that are, quote, normal weight, unquote, who are over fat. We call these people thin fats. They are thin, but they are fat. The most impressive example of this was a young woman we had with an illness called anorexia nervosa, in which a person is eating less and consuming less. This young lady was placed in a hospital in our area, and after 3 months and an expenditure of over $5,000, was still losing weight and was down to 89 pounds. And looked very, very thin. We did a hydrostatic weight on her, and she turned out to be 24% fat. Now, that's not very fat when the ideal for women is 22%, but the point was that this was a person that looked cachectic, and yet she was fat. The reason she was fat is that they had enforced bed rest on her, and she'd been having muscle wasting. She was losing all of the basic enzymatic systems that she needed to produce energy. And exactly everything was being done wrong for this person because they were using behavioral modification. You can get out of bed if you eat. Exactly wrong. Placed this person into an exercise program with the notion of building up enzymes and muscles that are energy producing and completely ignoring all of the psychodynamics of why did you get this way and your mother and your father and your attitudes. Completely taking a reality therapy approach to this person of what do you want to accomplish and focusing on exercise, and the person now has achieved an increased muscle mass, increased weight, fitness, back in school full-time. In fact, is employed in our office. We liked her so much, gave her a job. She's a delightful young woman. So that the approach of measuring fatness then is basically not by the scales, but by hydrostatic weighing or by a similar approach such as that, if you care to measure it. I would say the one thing, though, that we're looking for in life is a reasonable appearance of yourself when you look at yourself and say, how do I feel? How do I look? And then measure and focus on fitness. Maintaining fitness is an extremely simple thing to do. In the point that I've listed on the overhead here, it takes approximately 15 minutes a day, approximately 4 days a week, to maintain fitness. Now, this is not the kind of fitness that will win you any prizes in international competition, but it's precisely the kind of fitness that will lower your medical bills over a lifetime in a way far more profound than any other way you can lower your medical bills, aside from avoiding cigarettes, which everyone here does, I trust. So if you keep yourself fit and avoid cigarettes, you can allow more physicians to have more vacations and earn less money and have more time off, and they will thank you, and you will thank you, and the National Health Service will thank you, because there will be less money spent on medical problems. 15 minutes a day, 4 days a week. At what level of exercise do you have to do? Completely unique to you. Don't look it up in a table anywhere. Just simply start. Decide that you have 15 minutes a day, 4 days a week, and do something. Now, what is the something you can do? If you're capable of walking or running, depending on your level of fitness, that's the most efficient thing you can do. Bicycle ergometers, jumping rope, climbing up stairs. There's a great many of aerobic activities, meaning oxygen consuming, that you can do. But by far, the most efficient for all of you who have no incapacity in terms of walking is the best. So start out walking and walk 15 minutes. See how far you go. The next day, try and walk a little bit further in the same 15 minutes. And if you're more fit to begin with, start out running. Or run a little, walk a little. Do it alone if you wish, or do it with somebody else, but don't compete with the other person. If you happen to be at the same level, fine. All you need is the 15 minutes. Start out, if you can, doing it every day, and preferably do it first thing in the morning. The only requirement for this is to have comfortable clothing, and I suggest you do it first thing in the morning, because there's no excuses then, for all of you are too busy, I'm sure, and you get distractions during the day. So make it the first priority. You can combine with this prayer and meditation, which is a fundamental part of the totally fit person, and you owe it to yourself and the people you love and that love you to give that kind of preventive maintenance to your machinery. 15 minutes a day, 4 days a week. In the questions and discussion, we can go into that in more detail if you wish. I'd like to summarize then with just a few points. The summary would say that maintaining fitness and controlling fatness depends on a lifestyle and diet style or eating behavior. No magic or pills or parlors or programs or shots or fad diets or machines will do the job. Don't blame mother or genetics. Get at it yourself. Now, the practical parts of the fit lifestyle include 15 minutes of aerobics at least every other day, which would be a total of 1 hour a week. Includes a different approach psychologically, the psychology of more. Too many diets, too many programs talking of the sort we're in today. Lay a heavy guilt trip on this and start listing all the things you can't do. As you've noticed, we've talked about 40 minutes and there hasn't been much said about what you can't do, but rather what needs to be added to the full life, the yield of which will more than repay itself in terms of longevity, increased mental alertness and fitness and health. So the psychology of more, what should people do more of? Well, they need more water. The lack of drinking water in our society is very, very alarming, as you can get from any questionnaire about people. And if you don't like plain water, drink bottled water or put a twist of lemon in it or herb tea or something. But water is an essential ingredient. And indeed, it appears that some of the drive for food that many people have is a learned drive to get water, which is contained in food, and that you can quell part of that apostat through water. More vegetables is an important part of the more philosophy of fitness. The reason that that's an important thing to emphasize is the more you eat of vegetables, the less you tend to eat of some of the other things, so you don't have to make a big issue of it. The other point of more for many people that have a trouble with fatness, ask them how many meals do you eat a day. It's incredible the number of people that have fatness problems of a major level who are 1 meal a day eaters or 2 meal a day eaters, particularly those who miss breakfast. Metabolically, what this is doing is giving the following message to your cells and mitochondria, saying, hey, he or she is going to starve us. Let's build up the systems that we have to store fat so that we can make it through the next famine. You're reminding your body of its century-old systems for dealing with famine, whereas if you pour in a slower, steadier source of energy, it's not going to tend to develop the fat-storing pathways that you do anytime you pour in excess energy into the system and it's got to go somewhere. So it's obvious that if you eat 3 meals and do more nibbling as opposed to less nibbling, you're going to be better off. Now, many of the people that have fatness problems say, my problem is I'm nibbling. It's not the nibbling that's the problem. That's the best thing you can do. It's what you nibble. And therefore, the psychology of Moore says, always have carrot sticks and celery and cut up pieces of apples, if you will, available and things like that. Peanuts, for that matter. Something that you're going to nibble on. The other psychology of more is more walking and more activity. Make energy-wasting choices. Unlike the discussion about technology where we're looking for energy-saving choices, we're now talking about energy-wasting choices. And the reason that this is an intrinsic good is it's going to keep you fit, and you're going to burn less oil in your automobile, and you're going to use less electrical energy in the elevator if the place is where you work, if you take the elevator. Now, if you work on the 70th floor, take the elevator up 65 and run up 5 floors. No excuses. You can take choices to increase activity. Instead of competing frantically and losing type A tension points to get the nearest parking place at the supermarket, at the movie theater, at the place of work, and the place of recreation, make a choice to park as far away as you possibly can each and every time, even if it's raining, which it sometimes does where I live. The psychology of change is, again, a positive approach, not a deprivation approach to the matter of fitness and non-fatness. Make choices in particular for non-caloric in place of caloric liquids. By that I mean, if you're a juice drinker or a milk drinker, make awareness of yourself that those are very caloric liquids. Indeed, a great many things that we've been told about juices and milk are simply wrong, particularly milk. Through the American Dairy Association and many of my good friends in the Midwest, milk has gotten a good name. I think it's very good for about 6 months of life, and after that it's a nice luxury. It's certainly not essential, and for anybody that has a fatness or any kind of gastrointestinal complaint, milk is about the worst thing you can do for yourself. We virtually stopped cutting out people's stomachs since we stopped ulcer people drinking milk, and many people that were about to have their colons extracted have been saved by simply getting them off milk. It's a great problem in society. Many people, at least 10%, have intestinal lactase deficiency and go around with bloating and gas and wonder what sort of new pill they can take. If they'd stop milk, they'd feel comfortable. But what we're talking about today is it's very caloric. Juice is likewise a great source of vitamin C, but so is a vitamin C tablet. And if you've got a problem with fatness, don't be taking in juices. Remember, juices are very concentrated sugars. As Dorothy said the other day, sugar is really sugar. You can get romantic about it, whether it's natural or unnatural. But a sugar molecule, once your cells grab onto it, is still a sugar molecule, whether it came from a glass of orange juice or a spoonful of honey. So make choices for non-caloric instead of caloric liquids. Make choices for complex instead of simple carbohydrates. That is to say, take whole grains instead of refined flours. Take vegetables instead of sugars. Take vegetables, in fact, instead of fruits. Fruits, though they're nutritious, are still sugar. And we feel a great many people are righteously eating fruit and wondering why they're not losing fat, because they're consuming gigantic amounts of sugar, however they get it. Make a choice further for vegetables as the focus of your diet instead of meat as the focus of your diet. As you know, when you go in a restaurant, the entree is usually defined by the meat course. Choose restaurants that have focuses in terms of salads and vegetables, and when you go to meat-oriented meals, which we still should enjoy, ask for the so-called bawa or take-home bag at the beginning of the meal, not at the end of the meal, and treat yourself to twice the pleasure by having the same dinner you're enjoying in this deluxe restaurant again tomorrow by taking home the meat, thinly slicing it up, and cooking it with your stir-fry in your wok along with vegetables, and you've gotten your $15 dinner for $7.50 twice. Think fitness instead of fullness. All of the things which our mothers and grandmothers and fathers and grandfathers have said to us, "Are you full? Have you had enough?" implies that fullness is a good state. It takes a change of mind and change of attitude to say that when I am full, I am sick. How many people here like to be nauseated and vomit? Nobody, right? So that be like sort of a little bit hungry all of the time and convert through a great act of faith and transformation the idea that when I'm hungry, I'm healthy, and when I'm full, I'm fat. So think fitness instead of fullness. Also think sweat is good. Now, a few years ago, you would have had to make a big issue out of this, particularly among many women that don't want to sweat. But now women are beginning to recognize, and men have always appreciated, that sweat is good. And I won't go on with that one. Think in terms of walking instead of riding when you have a choice. Bicycles are one kind of getting around, but think in terms of walking instead of riding. And in conclusion, laugh, love, work, and worship. Enjoy and fellowship with others. And take everything that we've said today with a bit of humor and good fellowship as we go forth trying to be less fat and more fit. What I'd like to do now is have the remaining 10 minutes or so with your questions and comments. I suspect many of you here are experts in this area, and I welcome your comments, which I will repeat or summarize for the tape. Please. Yeah, the question or comment is, the speaker says, if I eat a hearty breakfast, it sort of stretches my stomach and I feel hungry all day. The matter is what you eat for breakfast, certainly, and how much. If you eat a very carbohydrate breakfast, particularly the fast food carbohydrates with honey and fruit, you pour out insulin. Insulin then lowers your blood sugar, and you can get hypoglycemic. You get the hunger cravings about 3 hours later. You get sweaty, weak, shaky. And that then gives an appetite craving in which you tend to eat. Two things should be said. That response is, and this is not meant to be personal, but since the question comes from a person, it has to be stated so. That response is primarily seen in people lacking full physical fitness. That is, the athlete, the one that's trained aerobically, is able to maintain a steady energy source, like I said, with the log on the fire. Burns fat, maintains an even energy source, so that we see that response primarily as a signal. See, I don't even know you, and if you're, you can prove you wrong as an me wrong as an individual if you're an Olympic marathon runner, but the chances are that you're not able to run 6 miles without stopping, which would be a reasonable objective for you to do, and then you'd still be able to eat the same breakfast and not feel that feeling, provided that you keep very low the matter of simple and fast sugars. So it has to do with fitness and the composition of the breakfast. I still would favor eating 3 meals a day. Next question. Yeah, the question is whether low fat or skim milk would be better, and it certainly is from a caloric point of view. For the person who wants to take protein into their body, who perhaps is lower in meat or is on a vegetarian diet, that's a very good choice to make. Certainly for the person that has no problem with fatness, that's an okay choice. But if you're dealing with somebody who's 34% body fat or the equivalent of many pounds overweight, that would not be a wise choice. In other words, whenever a person wants to lose fat, that is traditionally lose weight, you should cut out calories where you can, and cutting out liquid calories is a good way to do it. Okay? Yeah, the question is whether an egg every morning is okay, and what about the Heart Association's point of view? As a practicing cardiologist, I've not always been popular with the Heart Association, but it turns out as the swing of the pendulum is coming back our way for the egg lovers, it turns out that it's okay to eat an egg for almost everybody. There are very few people that have certain inherited blood lipid disorders to which they have to be very, very low in their fats and cholesterol. As Dorothy said the other day, most of the cholesterol in your body is made in your body. The amount you make is increased by two things fundamentally, or three. You make more of it under stress. You can raise people's cholesterol by asking them tough questions. And you make more cholesterol when you flood the system with sugar. So I think that the balance in an egg, provided it's a single egg, is a good idea. Part of our psychology needs to be thinking single servings rather than double. One egg, not two. One piece of toast, not two, if we have fatness problems. Make sense? Yeah, the question is the role of roughage and bran, and that's a good question. That's really an excellent addition to diet. In fact, is one of the problems why there is more colon disease and other disease in our culture is the lack of roughage and bran. It's filling with zero to minimum calories, depending on what form you take. So it's a very excellent addition to your diet. A little fit. Yeah, the question is about Dr. Cooper's character. We just had a fat little chipmunk run by here, and it's part of a visual aid for this thing. He's picking up the popcorn you dropped last night. But he's fit, you see. He's fat, but he's fit. And yes, Dr. Cooper's books on aerobics are sort of the Bible for people that are into this, and you can get into counting fitness points per week, as they've done. You can get into, even in the book that I've mentioned and recommended for you to read, Fit or Fat, gets a bit into some of the counting your pulse and so on. You notice that I've not mentioned that you do that necessarily. You can over-exercise and you can under-exercise, but if you start a habit of regular exercising and then start pushing yourself gradually, you'll reach a point of just gradual discomfort, but not severe discomfort. By that I mean it should be enough that you're aware that you're doing some exercise, but it shouldn't be so much that you're really uncomfortable. You should be able to talk, for example, while you're walking or running. If you're not able to talk, you're exercising at too high of a level. On the other hand, if it's just a stroll with a grocery cart, it's really not enough. Yeah. Yeah, the speaker has raised the issue about heart rate indices for fitness. You notice, too, that I didn't bring that up until it was brought up in the questions. I don't personally believe in heart rate indices. The reason is that for some people, the so-called target heart rate based on age and sex is too high, and for others it's too low. I believe that rate of perceived exertion is a better index, which means that you should feel like you're sweating and doing a little exercise, and you should keep a diary or a mental or written diary, preferably written if you have trouble with adherence, and just simply try and do a little bit better slowly as time goes on. That will achieve fitness, and all of the formulas for heart rate and so on can lead you into errors in either direction, in my opinion. Yeah, there are two questions about the so-called second wind phenomenon and the phenomenon of hitting the wall that runners and others observe. Neither of these are definitively understood, but it appears that the second wind is probably a shift in, if you will, calling in the reserves enzymatically. You really have called into these slower energy sources from the free fatty acid metabolism, mobilizing those and getting them burning and going. Hitting the wall appears to be the irreversible accumulation of lactic acid and other toxic properties so that it causes a nerve paralysis and you simply aren't able to go any further. A couple more questions and then we'll adjourn and take informal comments after. Please. Yeah, the question relates to my comment about fruits and sugars, and fruits are certainly nutritious, but fruits are a source of sugar, and for the person who is fit and not over fat, fruits are an important part of a balanced diet. However, we see a great many people that are not fit, that are having hypoglycemic reactions, and who are having fat loss problems, where they're eating a lot of fruit per day, they would be well advised to take a complex carbohydrate in the way of carrot sticks, or something of that sort in place of fruit if they're trying to lose fat and avoid this hypoglycemic type rebounding. See, insulin as a hormone is involved in the sugar story, and the principal role of insulin indeed relates to more to its fat storage and the full fat story than it even does to the sugar burning part of it. Yeah, the question is, how do you reach and maintain a plateau and know that you're there? This, again, I don't recommend heart rate tables, which you'll find for that, because there's just too much variation, not to speak of certain paradoxes with certain illnesses that you can go wrong on. What we recommend there is just, again, rate of perceived exertion. When you're doing 15 minutes and you come back and you say, gee, I feel like I've had a good workout, that's it. Now, that sounds terribly subjective, and scientists are traditionally supposed to not like subjective things. But from a biostatistical point of view, the thing that matters in science is not subjective or objective, but reproducible. It's an extremely reproducible event if we take you on a treadmill or take you out running for the level that you'll achieve at which you say, that's where I am. And you don't get much better than that without a lot of extra effort. So if you're going to go into competition, it takes considerably more effort than we've talked about in the presentation today. So it's simple-minded and it's how you feel. I will throw in one other comment. After you've been ill, and when you have an acute viral illness, you should not go out and exercise. Viral illnesses invade the muscle as well as they invade the other muscles, invade the muscle of your heart as well as the other muscles, and you have, in fact, kind of a myocarditis with many flu-like illnesses. So one should not push themselves to go out and run and exercise in that setting. The bell tolleth, and it tolleth for us. I will stay around and answer any other questions. And thank you very much for coming to this session.